that? That's what an estimated 500 horsepower sounds like. How about that? That's a premium Bang & Olufsen sound system with 18 speakers and a Beosonic sound experience. And that, that's our legacy. You ready to be a part of it? Unlock the energy of the all-electric ZDX Type S. Order now at Acura.com.
You're listening to a Mint podcast brought to you by HD Smartcast.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of the Why Not Mint Money podcast. Today, I have invited Ashish Somaiah, who is the CEO of White Oak India, to share his insights on how to manage our personal money and what lessons he has learned as a CEO over the years.
Welcome to Why Not Mint Money, a personal finance podcast where we help you understand basic money concepts and share strategies for you to build your wealth. So let's get started with your money journey.
Hi Ashish, thanks for coming and great having you in our studio.
It's a pleasure, Shashin. Thanks for inviting me.
So yeah, the agenda is to, you know, just figure out how a mutual fund CEO manages his own money. We obviously know what your mutual fund and PMS portfolios are doing, but it'll be very interesting to know how you as a person manage your money. But before we, you know, start with that, can you just tell me a little bit about your background, how you came into the industry, and how long have you been working in this field, by the way?
So, you know, I joined, now it's called ICICI Prudential Mutual Fund. Back then it was called Prudential ICICI Mutual Fund. I joined them as a management trainee in 1999, actually as a summer trainee in 1999, and then I just got, you know, on rolls of the company. So I've been around since, yeah, you can say 1999, associated with the industry. In terms of background, I'm a Gujarati, born and brought up in Mumbai, never lived in Gujarat. So I identify myself more as a Mumbai person or a Maharashtrian person, really. You know, I studied in Vivek Vidyalaya School, which is in a suburb of Goregaon. So I'm one of the few people who still lives where he was born. I was born in Goregaon, I still live in Goregaon. I did my schooling in Mumbai. I did engineering. I'm a chemical engineer with specialization in polymer science. So that's got to do with manufacturing, you know, plastics and related chemicals. Worked in a factory for a couple of years. And then, you know, back then they used to pay engineers very poorly. So after my engineering, I studied finance. So I've done a postgrad in finance from NMIMS. And then after that, I told you, I joined ICICI Mutual Fund. So that's how it plays out.
Got it. So you were in the mutual fund industry even before I was born. So a lot of experience there.
Yeah, but that's where that's where the private sector industry was, you know. I mean, private sector industry came in 1993. Prudential took stake in ICICI Mutual Fund in 1998. And I'll tell you, I don't think you missed much. When I was a trainee, the assets under management were less than 1,000 crores. For the firm that I was working with, the assets were less than 1,000 crores. And if I'm not wrong, the whole industry was less than 15,000 crores. And UTI back then was the, what do you call, 90-pound gorilla or whatever it's called. Yeah, the humongous. 15,000 crores was humongous. The firm I worked was not even 1,000 crores.
Got it. So, Ashish, but tell me one thing. So, how did you transition, you know, your journey from starting as a summer trainee?
Yeah.
Let's say starting from a chemical engineering background to taking finance, to starting as a summer trainee, to now becoming the CEO of White Oak and... How many crores they manage? They manage in India, they manage, you said, more than $2.5 billion?
Yeah. So White Oak as a firm, I mean, it's a White Oak Capital Group, which is a very, very large FII investing into India. So it's a Singapore-based asset management company. Yes, you're right in demarcating. I'm CEO for the global, for the domestic business only. The domestic is about, 20,000 crores across PMS, AIF and mutual funds. So that's give or take 2.5 billion. But for White Oak Group, the global business is much larger. It's about $5.5 billion. So total assets are 8 billion. I am responsible for domestic business. And, you know, global is bigger because our founder, Prashant Khemka, he started White Oak in 2017. And his, by way of his background, I mean, he used to be CIO for Goldman Sachs Asset Management for their emerging markets business. So he's always been managing money for global investors, investing into India and other emerging markets.
cool. So, you know, a lot of people, you know, they start their journey, they start as an intern, as a summer trainee. So can you give some tips for them how to become a CEO in 15 years?
Yeah, so, you know, Sachin, what happens is that whenever you ask somebody about their journey, the backstory is always perfect, but the reality is never perfect. You know, so now if I come and tell you that, yeah, I always knew I will be a CEO, blah, 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 it will be all humbug, it will be rubbish. I mean, I wanted to, so two, three things I'll tell you. One is that, you know, after I did my chemical engineering, I worked in a factory, then I did postgrad in finance. I can tell you two things. One is that everybody with my background wanted to be a portfolio manager or an investment banking professional or a hotshot consultant or at least a corporate finance guy who becomes a CFO of a large firm. And I realized very quickly that if all these smart people are going to try and become portfolio managers, then I don't stand much of a chance. So I was not so smart. So I was actually one of the few guys who had that kind of background, but I started my career in sales because I quickly realized that probably here's where the competition is less, you know, because people with engineering background and finance, and I was a decent student. I can't say meritorious student, but I was a decently good student. So not many people with my background went into sales. And, you know, in our industry, sales is quite technical. It's quite consultative. It's not the caricaturish impression that is given out because, you know, you need to understand everything that an economist or a researcher or a portfolio manager thinks and practices. You need to understand that, but then you need to articulate it in a manner where the guy putting a 100 rupee SIP also should understand. So it's not as easy as is made out to be. And it doesn't, it's much different from the caricaturish impressions that people have of a sales job, actually.
Interesting, interesting. So, yes, so Ashish is telling everyone that don't go for CIO person, go for CEO because there is less competition there.
So that's what I said. You know, you don't know where you will end up, frankly. You know, I mean, when you say tips, say, for example, yes, one is that you should see where your competencies are and where you can differentiate and where you can excel. I think that's the limited message which would come out of it. But the other thing is also that, you know, as a youngster, I never had any terms and conditions that this is what I will do and this is what I will not do, right? Say, for example, over a long period of time, I know that I want to be in a leadership role. I want to be a CEO. I want to manage a firm, a large firm, where I'm responsible, you know, for stakeholders, employees, investors, and multiple other, you know, regulators, the government, you know, where I can impact an industry. So one had that kind of ambition. But if I say that, okay, in 15 years I want to be, or 20 years I want to be there, but what will I do tomorrow morning? You can't be very finicky about that. You know, you should have a general sense of direction, but you can't decide every morning that, you know, this job is beneath me, so I will not do it, or this job is what I want. You cannot be too fussy about the journey you will take. You can only be clear about the direction or the destination. And then when you reach the so-called destination, you realize it's only a journey, it never ends. But the point is that you should never be fussy about what you will do and what you will not do. As long as you are learning and as long as you are progressing, you should be willing to do whatever comes your way.
So yes, one step at a time, but keep on going. That's the message.
Absolutely. Very good summation. I gave you like a long-winded answer, but yes, one step at a time, take it as it comes. And as long as you are learning, you know, you should be willing to put in your best.
So Ashish, let's, you know, now come to our main point, which is how to manage our own money, right? So, you know, mutual fund products are easy for people like you and me because we are in this industry, but it's very difficult to understand for the whole majority of people.
Yeah.
So you know, people are confused how to manage their money and they end up, you know, giving money to any Tom, Dick and Harry. So why don't you, you know, share your journey of how you manage your money, where all you put in your money, and maybe that will create a framework for people.
Yeah.
So we're not saying you should copy, but you can obviously learn a lot by, you know, getting to know how Ashish is managing his own portfolio.
Yeah. So, you know, like many people or like most people, in the late 90s when I started earning, even I actually, you know, kind of dabbled in stocks. And I thought that, you know, some senior of mine from college or some friend said that, you know, buy this company, it will do very well. And maturity level, understanding level was probably not there. So, you know, just took a recommendation from someone, invested in that. Then, you know, the tech bubble burst, you know, a lot of companies' share prices tanked, so lost money. You know, had to, very embarrassed, had to ask money from mom. and you pay the broker for the loss which was made. So even my journey started that way. And then, you know, very quickly I realized that if I am telling everybody that you should be investing in a mutual fund, you know, then obviously I should be doing that myself. So barring those one or two bad experiences in the late 90s, early 2000s during that whole tech bubble thing, after that, pretty much it has been investing in mutual funds. And then, you know, as you become senior in our industry, any which way compliance and those, you know, you don't want to, first is, the, you know, the right way to do it is that if I'm a believer in mutual funds and if I tell everybody to invest in mutual funds, then I should be doing that myself. And second is that at the same time, you know, we have significant restrictions in terms of when you can buy, what you can buy, how long you got to hold, etc. And then you don't want to take any risks or any chances. So I don't do direct equity at all. Haven't done it for a long, long time. So I invest with mutual funds. Mutual funds are, you know, our portfolio management services. So invest in that only. And yes, other than equity, I do invest in real estate. So that is direct real estate. So I can say that I don't, I mean, everybody, like you, you gave a very good point. People should not copy. So I would term myself as two, three things. Take it as disclaimer if you like. One is I am an aggressive investor. Second is I don't claim to be very disciplined. So that's not how people should be, but that is how I am. You know, I can be truthful or I can be perfect. So yeah, so I'm an aggressive investor and I'm not very disciplined. And I invest in only two asset classes. Either it is equity or it is real estate.
Yes. So this is the interesting part, right? So this has gotten a lot of feedback on Twitter and LinkedIn. And this is about your real estate portfolio. So for context, a lot of mutual fund CEO which come to our episode and which give their mantra on how to manage money, many of them say 100% of their money is in equity. Or even if they have some amount of real estate, it has come through ancestral property, some gold here and there, but nothing out of the box. Everyone is investing only in equity. But you took a very interesting decision to invest 50% of your portfolio into real estate. So can you just, you know, run us through why you decided to do that, and, you know, what kind of properties are you, have you bought, and, you know, during what time?
So a couple of things, Sachin. You know, I am not unique. I guess your other guests are unique because I am reflecting what the Indian ethos is actually reflecting, right? I mean, in India, typically it is well stated that, you know, people by and large own a lot of real estate. They own a lot of gold. And in fact, they don't own much of capital market products. So I am not very unique, frankly speaking. I think a lot of the other people may be unique because they are only into capital market. But, you know, a couple of things. One is that I have, generally speaking, I have always invested in equity as well as real estate. Never in fixed income. No meaningful exposure to gold other than what we may have as a family. So it's always been only equity and real estate. Second thing is that for me, real estate, you know, for two, three reasons. So first is that a lot of time people think that if you're working in a mutual fund company, how can you be invested in real estate? So a couple of clarifications. When I said I worked for ICICI Prudential, and I've also been CEO of Motilal Oswal. So a couple of clarifications. It's not true that asset management companies do only equity or fixed income. In both my previous organizations, ICICI Prudential, under their alternate offerings, they manage real estate funds. Even when I was there, they were managing real estate funds. And as a product guy, as a sales and distribution or a marketing guy, I was involved in those. Second is, even when I was with Motilal Oswal, I was CEO of the asset management company, but they do have a real estate business. And a very close friend of mine was the CEO of that real estate business. And I was in some way involved with that also, right? So first is that mutual fund professionals should not be into real estate is not accurately true in terms of at least our professional background. Also, it's not true. And then beyond professional background comes the individual preferences. So my preference for real estate is for two, three reasons. One is that people are very colored by what happened in real estate, say from 2010-12 till about 2020-20, because the given wisdom or conventional wisdom is that it doesn't appreciate, it doesn't make returns. I think you should not be colored by that decade, because that decade, banks had NPAs, right? RERA just about came in, demonetization, GST, multiple things. You know, so the real estate sector has started getting professionalized and organized in the last 5 years. Before that, it was the Wild West. Like 30 years back, stock market was also Wild West, but then SEBI came in and things changed. So that is one, why you should not go by what happened in that decade. Second is, real estate is actually a factor of production. If you are very bullish on the economy and bullish on stock markets, I don't see how you can say I'm bearish on real estate, because to the extent, see, I never buy like 200 kilometers outside Mumbai, somebody is going to probably build a new city or a new airport and on a speculative basis buy a piece of land. No, that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about real estate as an actual factor of production, which could be residential, which could be commercial, correct? So I don't see how you can be bullish on the economy and bearish on real estate. I think it's not very logical. So for me, real estate is an extension of equity. But you know, there are a couple of advantages with real estate. One is that leverage in equity is extremely risky, and nobody wants to give you leverage for equity because it's a very volatile asset class. But real estate is a secured asset class, right? If you have 100 rupees of real estate, the bank will say, okay, you put, previously the banks used to do 100% finance. Nowadays they do 80% finance. But like we've already discussed, I am very old. Correct. So when I started investing, or when I've had past experiences, banks have financed pretty much 90 to 100% of the property value.
Ashish, let me interrupt you here for a while. You have this very interesting story where you bought a house at the age of, what was it, 27 or 28?
28, yeah.
Which is unconventional, because people that, you know, starting off their career, it's very difficult for them to even think of buying a house. So what was the plan, and, you know, how did it go?
So it is unconventional now. That time, the given wisdom from my parents and from my family, right? So let's be clear. I'm 48. So I'm more than twice your age, right? So that's why I'm saying conventions change. Okay. But yeah, when I started, my dad bought a house when he was 24. My dad was born in 1946. And I know for a fact my dad bought a house in 1970. This is real, right? So the given convention or the given wisdom when we were young, or if I were to ape my father, the given wisdom was that, you know, the moment you start earning, try to build your house. So conventions change and given wisdom changes. But yes, on your point, yeah, when I was about 28, yes, I bought a house. Like, I bought a house which was worth about 80 lakhs. And that time, like I said, the financing rules were different. So I paid 6 lakhs, the bank paid 75 lakhs. I paid EMIs. But then, you know, this was 2004. And then property went through a big boom, and, you know, so look, my capital is maybe hardly 10%. The bank has put 90%. And of course, I was good credit. I never defaulted. The property I bought was like a proper apartment in the middle of the city. So the bank didn't have any risk. Right. So that's what I was telling you, that real estate is the only asset class where you can have healthy leverage if done right. There are many things people leverage for. According to me, you should never leverage for something which does not have underlying cash flows.
People, most people consider leverage as a risky thing, especially.
It is risky.
So, isn't this very out of the box?
It is risky. It is out of the box. But that is why I'm putting so many caveats that, you know, you should never leverage for something which will not have underlying cash flows. Like after 2-3 years when the building was made, I started getting rental income. So that's why I said you should not leverage for something where there is no visibility of cash flow, number one. Number two, you should never leverage for things like pie in the sky, 200 kilometers outside Bombay, buy a piece of land thinking the highway will come here. That is risky. But, you know, it's all about, life is all about taking calculated risks, right? So there is, according, in my book, there is something called healthy leverage. Leverage by its own is not a bad word. It has to be done right.
Interesting. And Ashish, can you tell us...
And where else will a 28-year-old get capital to build a house or to build an asset? Yeah, sorry.
And obviously, leverage also... When we say leverage, you should take it from a proper financial institution and not...
Of course, I was good credit. There was a proper homework done. I mean, I had to show them my educational background. Where am I working? What is my salary? How will I be able to pay or not? How will I pay? I mean, they did a proper evaluation. It's all fair and square. And, you know, so it's all above board. You're right. It has to be done in a right way.
So, Ashish, coming to the next point, can you tell us a little bit about, you know, who you admire as an investor, or do you have any, you know, investment guru? So, White Oak is generally mostly, and this is my understanding, is mostly an equity-oriented firm and a long-only firm.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
No, so equity, see, what happens is that, you know, because I have invested half equity, half real estate, it tends to the real estate part in today's world. 20 years back, it would not have drawn so much attention. In today's world, it draws attention, and the fact that I'm an equity professional. So if you see for equity, I mean, you know, equity, if you ask me, one thing I've been blessed with is that I've had fabulous bosses, you know, and they are all people in the industry who I've learned from. Correct. So my first boss, for example, Mr. Pankaj Razdan, he used to be CEO for, you know, ICICI Prudential Mutual Fund and then Birla Sun Life Insurance. You know, he's somebody who I learned a lot from. He was my first boss. Then Nilesh Shah, who is now the CEO for Kotak. Then Mr. Nimesh Shah, who's still the CEO for ICICI Prudential. Then I became CEO for Motilal Oswal. So I worked closely and learned a lot from Mr. Ramdev Agarwal. And then the other co-founder, that is Mr. Motilal Oswal himself. And then my lead director on the board was Mr. Naveen Agarwal. So these are, you know, I've been blessed with great bosses. And now, of course, Prashant, who's our founder, who is also a, you know, what is unique is that White Oak is probably the first asset management company founded by a professional CIO and run by professionals. So Prashant is someone who I'm blessed to learn from. So I've been blessed with great bosses. So I can't say that I have a guru. And I have not been a portfolio manager myself. I mean, I can say that I'm very passionate about equity. And I think I would claim that I have good understanding. But, you know, it's all because of exposure to great leaders and bosses.
Ashish, can I ask you to recall one lesson, be it of business, investing, or any other aspect of life, you learn from each of your boss? So you said Nilesh, you were reporting to Nilesh at one point.
Yes.
Motilal Oswal, Ramdev Agarwal, Prashant now.
Yes.
So,
So two, three things I can tell you. One, you know, the first lesson I always remember, enduring memory. First thing I learned is, one of the times my mom told me something. Obviously, she's, one thing I learned, you know, my mom told me long back, we all have a habit of praying to God and we think that God deigns something or ordains something or God decides something. But at least when I was a kid, my mom told me long back that God does not deign anything or ordain or decide anything for you. God only says tathastu, which means that God is with you in whatever you do. So that is one lesson that, you know, that I've learned, that it is you have to do the right things. God is with you in everything that you do. That was one lesson which I always learned, you know. Second, and you know, for example, we are from a family where we, you know, say Nadwara Srinathji or Laddu Gopal, you know, the Balkrishna, we pray to Balkrishna typically. Balkrishna, the God is a kid. So we were taught, when we were kids, we were taught that the God you're praying to is a kid. You're not supposed to ask anything from him. You're supposed to take care of him or you're supposed to do seva. But on business, so this is what I learned from my mom, but on business, I'll tell you a couple of things. For example, Pankaj, who was my first boss, he told me that leadership is the, you know, demonstration is the best form of leadership. There are some bosses who sit in air-conditioned rooms on an ivory tower and give instructions. At least, sometimes you've seen that. Pankaj told me that, you know, the best form of leadership is demonstration. You have to be able to do, you have to be an execution person yourself. Then, for example, Mr. Ramdev Agarwal taught me something interesting. He once told me that, you know, he was talking about business, but he gave an example of high-quality tailoring. Say, for example, you know, we all wear formal clothes and we wear suits, for example. So he once told me, do you know that, how do you stitch a good suit? So obviously, he was not referring to tailoring, but he told me that, how do you stitch a good suit? So, you know, Sachin, a good suit is not stitched because of the stitching. It is a good suit will be stitched only if the cutting is good. Okay. You know, anytime you go to a master or a tailor, you see the first thing they lay out the cloth and with the chalk, they start doing the markings. And as per the markings, it is cut. The learning is that once you cut it wrong, it's over. There's no way you can. The finest of stitching is not going to do anything once you cut it wrong. So, you know, when you build a business, what's your business design? What is your cost structure? What is your organization structure? Once those things are laid out, that will determine how the business will be built. You know, if you have the wrong business design and the wrong structure, then however much execution you do, it's not going to play out. So I've learned many things from my leaders and bosses, but you know, I just told you 2-3 things which is like, you know, absolute top of mind for me.
Also, what I really wanted to know is, since you're the CEO now, what kind of person you're looking to hire, you know?
Looking to hire?
Yeah, I mean, obviously you're the CEO, you must be hiring a lot of people.
Yes.
So what qualities you look for when hiring someone or when taking someone in a leadership team?
Yeah. So I'll tell you first, you know, I should tell you my negatives. I'm somebody who is, say, you know, I'm not a very, very, I would say that I am not easy to work with. Okay, so I'll first tell you my negatives and then I'll tell you what I look to hire. So one is, I'm not easy to work with because I would call myself a straight talker. I find it very difficult. I find 2 things difficult. I find it very difficult to understand messages which are layered. And at the same time, I find it very difficult to give messages which are layered or sugar-coated. Right. So it doesn't always work out well. But generally speaking, I would say that I'm a straight talker and I'm a transparent person. Now, this doesn't always go down very well with anybody and everybody. So that is one negative for me. But yes, in terms of hiring people, so it automatically stands to reason that I would end up looking, being more comfortable with people who are straight talkers. Correct. Second is, I think that people who are, like I said, you know, people who are very stuck up with what I will do, what I will not do. You know, see, there is always, everybody has a job definition and everybody has a remit in which they are operating. But generally, people who do very, very well are the people who are not very, very stuck up about what they will do, what they will not do, and who have a broad definition of their remit. You know, so that means that you have to be outcome oriented. You have to be objective and data centric. I think these things one would look for. I mean, people who read a lot, people who are good communicators, people who are doers. Like, say, for example, I'm not a big fan of delegating everything, and I'm also not a big fan of people who delegate too much. I mean, delegation should be done with a framework. It should not be done to the extent of abdication. So, yeah, these are just few top-of-mind things for me.
Interesting, interesting. Also, shifting the gear a little bit, let's talk about some light stuff, you know, regarding money matters. So, anything you learned from, you know, childhood money lessons you know carried on. So obviously, because I have this money lesson, so you know, when I was in let's say class 2, 3, 4, 5, I used to have this, everyone used to have this habit of eating junk food, right?
Yeah.
So my dad one day came and made a deal with me. The deal was, he would pay me 10 rupees every day if I didn't have any junk food for that day.
Wow.
And slowly the money became so big. So obviously I was getting holy money, stuff like that. But after some point, my purse became so thick that even my parents started borrowing money from me. This is a true story. And you know, that habit kind of stuck.
Fabulous.
With
me. Yeah.
But obviously the plan failed when I told my dad, now I have saved like 30,000. Now I want to buy a phone. Then he said no. Then the whole plan, you know, fell apart.
He said, might as well have eaten burgers.
Yeah, thought so.
Yeah. So, you know, if you ask me, see, I had a very challenging time. The reason being that my dad passed away when I was a kid, you know, maybe I was 13 years old. And, you know, back then it became, for a few years, things became quite challenging because my dad used to work for State Bank of India. And then, unfortunately, he passed away in an accident. And then my sister was studying and I was studying, and, you know, we had like, it was a bit tense or a delicate situation. But, you know, ever grateful to State Bank of India and Government of India, because they had a policy that they would give a compensatory job to the next in line. So my mom was a housewife. One fine day she had to become a clerk in State Bank and, you know, become a clerk come cashier and just suddenly take up a job. And obviously that job was not paying as well as what my dad was being paid because he was a senior person. So early life, you know, and frankly, a lot of time we make a lot of song and dance about the fact that I was from a lower middle class family. I mean, look, the whole of India was lower middle class 30 years back, so no great deal about it. But yeah, I mean, childhood and college and all was a bit challenging. And in fact, when I used to study in B school while I was dependent on my mom and my sister, I used to do all types of projects just to pay my fees and, you know, earn a bit of money. So my learnings, and previously also, you know, we're like a huge joint family. Money was not like free. I mean, I can't say I was poor, but money was not free flowing is how I would put it. So, earning money and money as a means of comfort and happiness, that was the general sense that, you know, I mean, very early in life, I understood money is important. And a lot of the things which people say, you know, like in Hindi, they say, paisa hathon ka mail hai, and, you know, don't look at money. Because when we were kids, you know, on one hand, we were always told that if I went to somebody's house and I told my mom, these people look very rich, man, they're doing much better than us. Then my mom would say, is that the only thing you observed? You're so money-minded, right? So we were always taught that you should not be money-minded. But when I looked at the real world, it was actually very money-minded. So one had to kind of reason it out that what role money actually plays. And one realized that, yeah, I mean, it's important.
This is a very fascinating story. And, you know, when your dad passed away at 13, your family wasn't doing that well because obviously your mom got the job, but it was a clerical job. It wasn't paying very well.
Yeah.
But at least, you know, she had something to, you know.
Of course. That's why I said I'm ever grateful to State Bank of India and the government of India.
So, Ashish, now my question is, do you plan for any such situation? So let's say, how should I keep it? How are you planning your finances in such a way that even if something happens to you today, then nothing should bother your family or...
Yeah.
And this is not just about the amount, but so I work in personal finance and we get a lot of queries saying...
Yeah.
Like, I'm not getting the money, nomination problem, document problem.
So, you know, see, just like we discussed equity and real estate, I'm as much passionate about insurance and need for insurance. And I would say I would not mince words, I think men are the culprits. See, what happens is that when people want to talk about empowering women, and when people want to talk about, you know, taking care of the women folk in the family, and people talk about financial awareness or education for women, I think it's the men that need to be educated, honestly, right? Because somehow, for some reason, men think they're invincible, right? They think that, you know, all these accidents and all these challenges, they happen with others. It's not going to happen with me. Somehow, most men think that they're invincible and they think that they're going to be around forever and ever and that they're going to provide for their families. The second thing I have seen is that wives don't seem to know what the men are up to. Right, like I can tell you, honestly speaking, if I pop it today, my wife will know exactly what to do, whom to call.
Okay, so you're talking about the, you know, where is the money?
She's right from my salary account to the last pie that I'll have, she's a joint holder. She knows exactly everything. Second thing is, she knows exactly who is my insurance advisor, whom to call, what is the amount of policy, etc., etc. She knows everything. And I'll tell you something, that the insurance that I've taken, I hope that they'll have emotional turmoil, but I can assure you they will not have any financial turmoil. They will not miss me financially, that I'm quite sure. Okay. Yes, emotionally, they will miss. I hope they miss. But
we all will.
So I think that, you know, I think we have to, empowering means, that's what I said, that is the men who need to be educated, not the women. I think the men are the culprits.
Got it. And Ashish, another important point that I wanted to touch upon is retirement planning. So everyone is talking about retirement planning. People want to retire at 35. Nowadays, yeah. Fire thing is going on. So what's your retirement plan?
See, one is on this fire. I find it a bit of a conundrum, because on one hand, we talk so much, the technology will change the world. You know, human beings will live till 100. I read a book which says future is faster than you know, written by Peter Diamandis. He says that by 2035, 2040, I think kidneys will be grown in the lab. Right? Example. So, on one hand, we are saying that medical science is evolving so much that we are going to live all like 95 and 100 and stuff. Right? On one hand, we are saying that technology is going to make jobs, you know, obsolete. On one hand, we are saying that we don't even know whether we'll be dealing in US dollars or Indian rupees or Chinese yuan or Bitcoin or what. So in keeping all this in mind, I am very scared about any sort of retire early kind of plan, because I don't know how the world will change, how the landscape will change. In fact, I am thinking, how will I keep myself relevant, right? So I'm not, honestly, in my own humble opinion, I am not a big fan of financially independent retire early, because I would be very insecure. So I don't see myself retiring. In fact, I would try to keep myself relevant as long as I can, and I hope I don't have to retire. But yes, in terms of retirement planning, I mean, all you can do is, you know, look, you can just make sure that you have not frittered away all that you earn and you save enough. And, you know, when we were talking about real estate, one thing I didn't clarify to you, part of the reason for having, you know, everybody cannot start buying real estate on day one, right? So you have to, over a period of time, you have to save and you have to accumulate and you have to take the right bets, all of that we've been through. But one reason for having real estate is because I can, if I retire, or if I become irrelevant, I'll get some rental income. That's the only thing. So that's how I think about it.
That's an interesting point, that if you pay off your EMI over the year, then you have a free cash flow that is coming to you month on month.
Yeah. So, you know, see, typically in all this, how it happens is that the rent pays the EMI. And then automatically, obviously, your equity starts rising. So if you buy at the right time, the property price will appreciate, plus the rent will pay the EMI. So anyway, your equity is going up, right? So that's a very long-drawn strategy, but one of the things is to figure out how you can earn some rental income. And of course, I do invest in equity. I mean, half the money is equity. I hope it appreciates. White Oak's funds will do very well, so it will appreciate. So that's how it works.
So Ashish, on this point, so we were talking about money all along, but we didn't touch more specifically on equity. So shortly, if there is a person who is a beginner and wants to invest in a mutual fund for the first time, not just White Oak, but if he's looking at the mutual fund category as a whole, what is the starting point? I mean, how, obviously there are more than 1,000 mutual fund schemes in India, and it can be very confusing,
very difficult,
and NFOs are launching left, right, center. So I mean, what's the way to look at mutual fund, and how to select mutual funds so that people don't make silly mistakes?
So, you know, look, everybody has their own journey. There are enough number of people who start with direct equity, enough number of people who start with FNO, enough number of people who start with small cap fund, sectoral fund, thematic fund, etc. But for everybody, there's one simple suggestion. You know, you can discover what excites you and what interests you and what works for you. You can discover all that later. The simple message is that if you don't know what to buy, you buy the market, right? So if you want to, you know, wet your feet, just enter the market. The simplest and easiest is to buy Nifty 500 index fund, because that's the whole market pretty much, or a total market index. You know, now you have that. One of the providers has that also. Yes. So you just buy the full market. In 100 rupees, if you can buy exposure to the whole market through an index fund, what else do you need? Like in my previous role, for example, the first Nifty 500 index fund I was involved in launching, the first S&P 500 index fund I was involved in launching, I'm very proud of that.
In Motilal?
Yes, when I used to work for Motilal Oswal, I was involved in launching those funds. Very proud of that. Now, you know, if with 100 rupees you can buy NASDAQ, with 100 rupees you can buy S&P 500, and with 100 rupees you can buy Nifty 500, that's a great way to start. Eventually, you will discover what is White Oak's investment philosophy. How do they manage money? Are they beating the benchmark or not? How do they plan to beat the benchmark? Or you may discover some other manager, or you may discover some themes. So that's a process of discovery. But today, starting today, if you have no clue what to do, best way to start, if you don't know what to buy the market. It's the easiest thing to do. At least you will get started.
Do you have any allocation to international market?
Yes, White Oak manages actually, you know, so we save money in equity. We also save through LRS, right? I mean, so White Oak has a Global Emerging Markets Fund. So I invest in Global Emerging Markets Fund.
And in,
it's a lesser known fact.
In which country?
So White Oak's Global Emerging Market Fund invests in, you know, the benchmark is MSCI Emerging Markets Index, which means it has exposure. The benchmark has exposure to 27 countries.
So this wouldn't include US and all, right? Because the name says emerging markets.
Yeah, it's Global Emerging Markets Fund. So it would invest in emerging markets. So China, Taiwan, South Korea, Latin America, Eastern Europe, all of those.
What about investing in likes of Google, Netflix?
Yeah,
since
unfortunately,
you are also part of the launch of NASDAQ.
Yes. No, I have invested in the past, but currently, frankly speaking, I have exposure only to India and emerging markets. Right now, I have not invested in any American portfolio.
So, Ashish, we have talked for very long and I'm taking too much of your time. But so this last answer, question that I'm going to ask you, this has to be a very honest answer, okay? So, since you are a CEO, since you have been working for 20 years, what is the best way to sell a mutual fund? So, imagine you're talking to a MFD or a RIA. If you want to give any advice to them, how to better sell mutual funds, then what one or two advice would you tell them?
See, you know, there are two things in this. One I have seen is that a lot of people, they, you know, a lot of asset management companies, insurance companies, a lot of messaging is about, we will help you achieve your life goals, we will help you fulfill your dreams. I personally find it quite fuzzy. Let us say if a person has decided to invest in mutual funds, you know, and let's say you're trying to just basically understand what's the time horizon. You know, are they a risk taker or not a risk taker? Should it be equity or fixed income? Do they need liquidity or they can invest and keep it for long term? Are they going to do a bullet investment or an SIP? So after you've done that basic tick box exercise, and let's say assuming that this person is going to invest in equity, right? You should just say what you will do. Right? Like, I should just say that what is it in my constitution whereby I will be able to do better than the benchmark or better than my peers? So my personal opinion is keep it focused to what you can do for the customer. Let's not get into, you know, I will fulfill your dreams, I will build your dream house. I don't think when we are managing money in the stock market, we have to use our expertise to beat the benchmark or to do better than most. I mean, White Oak believes in a performance first culture. So we would try to beat the benchmark by as high a magnitude as we can based on our research and portfolio construction. So I think that everybody should focus on telling the client what they can do. We should make sure that we completely abstain from showing any kinds of rosy picture or like a, you know, I find that a lot of advertising or a lot of communication is very fuzzy, very emotional, very emotive. I think clients are smart people. They want to know what you can do for them. You know, you don't need, I mean, just by beating the benchmark by 4-5% or 3%, am I going to build somebody's dream house or fulfill all their dreams? I don't know what their dreams are made of, right? I should just say what I can do and I should talk about my credentials. I think that would keep things more real and more objective.
Also, Ashish, what are some exciting things happening at White Oak? So, since you said performance is the first thing you look at, you know, while working at White Oak, and also there are a lot of new developments, new kind of investment happening in the mutual fund industry, right? Quant funds are coming up.
Yes, of course.
Factor-based ETFs. So any exciting model of investments coming in?
So, you know, my learning is like this. It's very interesting you mentioned about factor-based investing. You know, so just for uninitiated, you might say that growth is a factor, value is a factor, large, mid, small, size of market cap is a factor, every sector in itself is a factor, right? So what I've seen is that what people should understand, that at any point in time in the market, depending on macroeconomic conditions, some or the other factor will be dominant. And funds whose portfolios are heavily biased in favor of that factor, they'll be number one. And the other guys will all be at the bottom. So when macros change, which style, which sector, which factors will work in the market, that will change. And that you must have observed that the best performing fund manager and best performing fund house changes every 18 to 24 months. The winners rotate. Why do you think that happens? That happens because while everybody talks about stock picking, the reality is that a good part of their alpha is coming by being with the right factor, and the right factor gets determined based on the macroeconomic conditions. So in fact, at White Oak, the effort is to build factor balanced portfolios. So we are not growth or value, contra or cyclical, defensive or, you know, domestic or export. We are blended, which means that the factors, the way they appear in BSE 500 is composed of all factors. It is Sarvagun Sampan, right? So the way the factors appear in BSE 500, we try to be factor balanced. it's not like we have no biases. We have only two biases. We want acceptable level of governance, and we generally think that we will get alpha from small and mid cap. So you will generally find us overweight small and mid cap, and you will generally find that we are having good governance. Right. Other than that, we have no biases, which means we are trying to make a portfolio which is factor balanced. If we do well, we should be top quartile. If we do badly, we should still be in the middle. We don't want to have wild swings in performance. Wild swings come when your portfolio is very biased in favor of certain factors. So we try to make it factor balanced and ensure that we don't have wild swings.
Also, we were talking just before this podcast that you have 30 members in the research team,
yeah,
which is a huge number, because
yeah,
in the mutual fund industry, even the big bank sponsored AMCs have
yeah,
typical 15-20 analysts.
Yes.
Sometimes even lesser.
Yeah.
So what's...
So see, I think it's the model, you know, like, see, if your portfolios are like, you know, if you're distinctively growth or value, or if your style is such that you believe in certain factors or certain themes, then your research would be relegated to that. Or, you know, your research will be biased in favor of that. Or, you know, your portfolio composition will be favored that way. Since we make factor balanced and we invest across the market, large, mid, small, micro, and across sectors, there's nothing which is a no-no for us. We just, like I said, you know, reasonable, good governance, you know, and like I mentioned to you, so we are a broad blended investor. And our coverage is more than 700 companies. So everything above 1,000 crores is part of our coverage. And our team would rank every company in the coverage based on their business characteristics as rank 1, 2, 3, 4. And we'll try to, and 4 is like something which we don't want to invest in because of bad governance, bad business structure. But typically our portfolio would be mainly into rank number 1, rank number 2, sometime rank number 3. So we cover the entire universe, rank it for good business, great business characteristics. And that necessitates that, you know, we have deep coverage. Like we, that's why we have more than 30 people covering more than 700 companies. There are certain sectors where we have, sector itself, we have 6-7 people. Like BFSI would be 8-9 people.
Oh.
Pharma and healthcare and chemicals would be 5-6 people. Consumer would be 7-8 people. So large team covering right from large cap to mid cap to small cap to micro cap and across sectors. And, you know, we are bottom up. Like, see, we don't want to generate alpha based on any factor bets. We want portfolio to be factor balanced. So we want alpha to come from individual stock picks. So we need deep coverage.
Interesting, interesting. So Ashish, before I let you go, you have mentioned a lot of books, even during this podcast and even when we were talking before this.
Yeah.
So for our audience, can you recommend one book which you really liked and, you know, what you like from that book? Because typically a book, you know,
yeah,
if a person really likes a book, then
yeah,
that book kind of defines how the person functions in a lot of ways.
Yeah. So I'll tell you 3-4 books which are, which may be from different areas, you know, which you're right that it has influenced me. For example, one book on marketing and strategy, which I love, is a book written by Adam Morgan, which goes with the name Eating the Big Fish. It's a very exciting book. There is a book, you know, we all, when we are in B school, we read Michael Porter. But those are tomes, you know, Competitive Advantage, Competitive Strategy. Those are big tomes. I don't think anybody can claim to have read everything. But there's a very interesting book called Understanding Michael Porter, which is written by an author called Joanne Magretta.
Okay, some other person.
I think she was a student of Michael Porter. And she's written a book called Understanding Michael Porter. That's a fabulous book. There is a book, I'm an ambivert, but I used to think I'm an introvert. I used to think. So there is a book called Quiet, The Power of Introverts in a World That Can't Stop Talking. It's written by, I think, Susan Cain. For example, Predictably Irrational by Dan Ariely. I can't remember the name of the author, but there's a very interesting book called No One Understands You and What You Can Do About It. Can't recall the name of the author.
This is regarding?
It's about communication and about understanding people and how to relate to them, how to talk to them. Then there is a book called The Ultimate Sales Machine. That's written by Chet. I'm forgetting the second name, but Ultimate Sales Machine. It's a very interesting book. Investing, The Last Liberal Art by Robert Hagstrom. So these are just top of mind examples, but I love reading. Yeah.
Yes, so a lot of investing, and more importantly, sales book also.
I read about sales, I read about communication, I read about business, I read about investing. These are the four areas which I generally read about.
Any movies you want to recommend?
So, you know, it's unconventional, but there's a movie called Bruce Almighty.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. It's Jim Carrey.
Yes.
But I'm not recommending that movie to you because Jim Carrey is, quite funny or something. I'm recommending that book to you because, I loved the movie at least, is because it has a fabulous representation of what God could be. Like, I loved Morgan Freeman as God. he says one very interesting lesson in that. He says that even as God, he says he can change anything in the world. But what he cannot change is somebody's free will. I love that movie, actually. I mean, I watched it many, many times. And I watched it not for Jim Carrey. I watched it for Morgan Freeman and how he comes across as God.
Interesting. So, Ashish, thank you so much for coming to our studio for this episode. And hope to see you again for future episodes.
Thank you. My pleasure talking to you. Thanks for inviting me.
That brings us to the end of today's episode. If you would like to know more about this topic, then you can reach out to me on Twitter. I go by the username @SashinNJ or LinkedIn using my full name, that is Sashin Ningthau Khongjam. We would be happy to take your suggestions. That's all from our side. Thanks for tuning in. See you in the next episode.
To stay updated on this podcast, follow us at HT Smartcast on all the major social media platforms. To listen to more such podcasts, log on to www.htsmartcast.com.
Did you hear that? That's what an estimated 500 horsepower sounds like. Exco, give it to you. How about that? That's a premium Bang & Olufsen sound system with 18 speakers and a Beosonic sound experience. And that's our legacy. You ready to be a part of it? Let's go, give it to you. Unlock the energy of the all-electric ZDX Type S. Give up. Order now at Acura.com.